Welcome to the Restoration Church Podcast. To learn more about our church, give, share a prayer request, or access our weekly worship guide, visit us at www.restorationlex.com/this week.
Beautiful way to begin our day together. Welcome, my name is Justin. If we haven't met, really glad you're here. And today, as we read our lectionary passage earlier from Luke chapter 6, Sermon on the Mount is what we see in Matthew, and this is the Sermon on the Plain we see in chapter Luke. Very many similarities there. And so I want to begin today by asking a question. It's a hypothetical question because I hope you would not yell this out loud. Who is your enemy? Okay, nobody yelled anything. That's good. How would you respond to that, though? Like, if somebody just came up to you on the street and asked you, who is your enemy? I mean, if you're like me, you probably think, you know, there's some people that annoy me. There's some people that don't think like me, who take stands that are very different from mine. But to say I have an enemy is a little bit too far. And so when we talk about loving our enemies, like we read about earlier, that Jesus tells us this, we can very enthusiastically make this a sentiment that's just sort of a beautiful ideal. That, yeah, we all agree to this. We should love our enemies. That's what we do, especially in an increasingly divisive, polarized world. For a lot of my life, that's how I looked at this passage we just heard. I looked at it as if this was just a flowery ideal that we all should aspire to. Love your enemies. But I've increasingly come to have learned that the reason I don't have many real enemies is because when people and ideas and policies oppose me, it doesn't really cost me anything. It costs me nothing. And for the most part, it doesn't affect any of my everyday life at all. And I've come to learn that the difference between an annoyance and an enemy is what it costs you. So you might have some people or some things that annoy you, but does that annoyance, does that person cost you something? For millions of Christians across the world today, the choice to follow Jesus is not one, whereas here in America, sometimes it would be, a choice to step into upward mobility. It's not a choice to rise up in society. It's not the norm to just take on this position as if we assume there will be power. And so in following Jesus, for the most part, Christians across the world, they know in making this decision there will be a cost. Now hear me. I know that there are people in here. I know there are people in this room. I know there's people watching on the live stream right now. They have real enemies. You have people who have brought cost in your life, who have cost you relationally, who have cost you emotionally, and I do not want to discount that at all. But what I'm not talking about today, and I hope this is clear by now, is I'm not talking about the modern day American Christian persecution complex. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about any minor convenience or slight little loss of privilege being some sense an enemy, a persecution. That's basically the theological equivalent of professional wrestling. It's just for show. It may look real, but it's all scripted. The truth is that if we hold our faith from a place of privilege, when we hear these verses, we're almost at a disadvantage and our ability to understand them fully. And so if we're not intentional about stepping into the footsteps, the worldviews, the lens of people who experience Jesus at a cost, we will likely miss something. Jesus tells us, but to you who are listening, starts with that, I love that. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Those words we hear were not spoken from a place in an ivory tower of power. Jesus lived as an ordinary, likely very poor Jew under the oppression of Rome. They were constantly under the threat of violence, constantly under the unjust taxes where they were being robbed financially by this regime. So Jesus doesn't speak these words from a place of being on high. Jesus speaks these words from being among a people who, loving their enemies, actually would come at a cost. And it gives context to these words that Jesus gives us next. He says, if someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Now think about the reciprocity of these words. They aren't spoken on level ground, okay? What we see here is we learn that there's a certain type of people who have the ability to slap you and get away with it. There are certain types of people who have the ability to take things from you and face no consequences at all. Only people with more power than you can do that. So these words are spoken to a people in a context where there were people far more powerful who had the ability to step in and do violence and justice and face absolutely no consequence whatsoever. Now, to love your enemies when you have a handprint on your face is something a little different, isn't it? But that's the kind of love that Jesus is inviting us to. And perhaps our best teachers of this, because I know a lot of us are probably feeling at a disadvantage in understanding this, is the men and women of the civil rights movement. This past August, I think it was, myself and a few guys from here at church, we got to go to Alabama and visit a lot of these sites of civil rights movement, just incredible. In Selma, walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, got to visit where Rosa Parks was. It was just one of these surreal and life-changing experiences just to see these things up close and personal. And it was moving. It was moving. And one of the most powerful experiences for me was that walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It was raining a little bit, and at first there was a wonder of, well, you know, it's raining. I don't know if I want to get out in the rain and walk across this bridge. And then I was like, oh, remember the people that actually walked across this bridge? I think it's probably okay if you do that. On March 7th, 1965, known as Bloody Sunday, you see a picture here on the screen. They were marching from Selma to Montgomery. They were protesting on behalf of voting rights. But just as they crossed the bridge, they were met with brunt force violence. And we stood on this very spot where this happened, where these brave men and women, there was tear gas, there were clubs beating people down. And I couldn't help but think about the faith that we shared and the faith that I have that I believe they had too, and yet I wondered if my faith costs me anything. You see, for these people, they believed love your enemies courageously. And they knew what it looked like in Jesus' original audience to know that there are powerful people who could take advantage of you, who can do violence to you, and face no consequences whatsoever. But what Dr. King knew was that this power to oppress was actually not power at all. And the only power we have to stand against enemies who have this power over us is believing that there is power that is far above them. In his essay, Loving Your Enemies, he says, to the most bitter opponents, we say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. We cannot, in all good conscience, obey your unjust laws because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail, and we will still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at the midnight hour and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. Why can we love our enemies like that? We can love our enemies like that. We can turn our cheek and not grow weary because he that is in us is greater than he that is in the world. Because true power, what these civil rights activists, what the Christians in the first century knew is that power in the midst of empire goes far, far in a different direction. Power looks like a cross. Power looks like humility. And so in the face of perpetrators of violence, in the face of people who are taking advantage, agape love is possible because there is a rootedness and a love that is far more powerful than what those who come against us can ever do to us. Luke 6, Jesus continues. It says, if you love those who love you, what credit is that for you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies. Do good to them. And lend to them without expecting anything to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Jesus knows that it's one thing just to love our side, our team. To love people who agree with you, who look like you, who vote like you, who worship like you, who live like you, that's easy. It's easy, but as followers of Jesus, we are being invited into a different kind, a higher standard of love. A love that goes beyond what benefits us. A love that goes beyond when we think we are right. Jesus makes it clear here that our love is to seek the good, even of those who oppose us. It even harkens back to Jeremiah 29, verses 4 through 7, when the exiles are in the midst of Babylon, and he says, plant gardens, pray for those in your city, seek the peace, the shalom, the wholeness of your city, that you may flourish as well. Jesus says the same thing. Do good to even those who oppose you. Meaning, as Christians, we're called to love even at the cost of our earthly power, even at the cost of our success. And this is important for us right now in this cultural moment we find ourselves, and we're witnessing the slow decentering of Christianity from society, from places of cultural power and influence. Since the year 2000, church attendance has actually dropped 20%. It remained at about 70% from the 30s when they began measuring it up to the year 2000, and then it just began plummeting. The fastest growing religion in America right now, you know what it is? Those who claim no religion at all, no affiliation. Friends, the ground is shifting underneath of our feet. The ground is moving, and we can feel this right now. Now, in saying those things, what that would usually elicit in a sermon like this is sort of a fear of, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? It's no longer simply about what we believe, my friends. It's about how we believe it. And the world that is shifting underneath of our feet. The world will see our posture. The posture of Jesus, long before they hear our positions, our beliefs. As we see the cultural power of American Christianity begin and continue to wane in the days ahead, listen, I think we have two choices. We can fight culture wars, and we could try to maintain our power at all costs and compromise our position and to just maintain and hold on to every little piece of power we can in our society. Or I believe we could trust, like the followers of Jesus have for centuries, who operated outside of positions of power for millennia, that our compelling and uncompromising witness together as the people of God is far more powerful than what this world could offer. that we could be the politics of God, that we could be the alternative to what we see in the world, and that we, in refusing to compromise in order to grasp at power, show and bear witness to a power of a kingdom that is not of this world, but is for this world. I don't know about you, I choose the latter. I hope you know by now, I'm not going to be your culture war cheerleader. I'm not. And I hope you don't listen to culture war cheerleaders, because they're loud right now. What we have to do is figure out with what it means to follow Jesus in a very pluralistic society, meaning that Christianity is increasingly just one belief among many around us that we are bombarded by every single day. And that's the heart of what Jesus teaches next. Here's what he says. He says, do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. That's a picture there at the end of when they're measuring grain together. When they were doing business back in the day, you would pour it in. You can kind of get a little bit to make it look like you had everything filled. But when you shake it to make sure you get every single bit to measure, that's a way of doing something with integrity. He's saying when you measure and do things with integrity, that will be what you experience too. Now, those three words there, do not judge, may be, I would say, the most quoted Bible verse in the history of the Bible. And I would probably put forward that it's one of the most misunderstood. I think when we hear do not judge, a lot of people at least hear this is an ethical get out of jail free card. Like, I can just do whatever I want and don't judge me. Only God can judge me, you know, that sort of thing. And that's just not what we're seeing here. This word in the Greek for judge, krino, it comes from the root meaning of separating, to pull something apart. Right after this, Jesus says, do not condemn. And this word for condemn, it means to pronounce, to stand over someone as guilty. These two words go together, and they give us a picture of what Jesus is actually warning us not to do. And I hope you do not miss this. This is important. When we pull people apart, we pick them apart, when we separate ourselves from them, when we stand over people in judgment, when we feel it is our job to declare people guilty, that's what it means to judge. Jesus is not telling us that we are not allowed to know and say the difference between right and wrong. That's not what is being pronounced here. Another way of putting this is that do not judge does not mean do not discern. Do not judge does not mean you can't really know what is right or wrong. That's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is speaking about our tendency to stand over others as morally and spiritually superior, picking everything about their life apart to condemn them, but never, ever, ever, ever looking at ourselves or our side using the same tediousness. And what's at stake here is our posture towards those who we believe are wrong. There are going to be people, I would imagine, hopefully, you see out there who do not believe like us, and it's okay to say, like, I don't think you're right. But how we hold those beliefs matters immensely right now. Jesus actually, later on in Luke 18, he tells a story, this parable that is, I think, the perfect picture of what he's trying to tell us here in the Sermon on the Plain with do not judge. It comes in Luke chapter 18. Read with me here on the screen. It says, to some who were confident in their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get. Now, let's talk about right and wrong. Fasting, giving a tenth of all you got, good stuff. Robbing, evil doing, adultering, tax collecting, not good, right? Wrong things. But Jesus continues the story. He says, but the tax collectors, he stood at a distance. He wouldn't even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and he said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all those who humble themselves will be exalted. Who walks out of this temple justified? That word justified means in right standing with God. It is not the one who is morally upright. It is the one who has humbled himself before a holy God. That is the one who walks away right with God. We see over and over again in the scriptures that he is consistently looking beneath the surface, looking beneath the surface of even our good behavior, looking at the condition of where our hearts actually are. That's what the Holy Spirit does. He will not settle with just good-looking behavior on the outside. The Holy Spirit gets down to the heart of it. Now, as we read this, it's kind of a satisfying ending because, I mean, think about it. Aren't you tired? Aren't you all just tired of self-righteous, prideful, religious people who just make it their goal constantly to stand over others? Don't you just thank God that you're not like the... Oops. How easily we become the very thing we condemn. Because there are those who will stand over in moral judgment who we know and we oppose as enemies. But Jesus wants us to know that we can very, very, very easily become the very thing that we condemn them for. I think it's becoming increasingly clear as the world shifts beneath our feet that our posture towards the world shouldn't just be something that we consider Christian. It should be, it must be Christ-like. We cannot assume that something that is considered Christian is Christ-like. And all of this flows out of a humble confidence in God. You see, because God is my defender, I don't have to surrender to retaliation and violence. Because God is my provider, I don't have to fear losing out. I don't have to fear when I am taken advantage of. In fact, I can freely give because my God is a God of abundance and not of scarcity. I can refuse to stand over others in judgment because God alone is my justifier, not the people who stand around me, not the people I can compare myself to. I can look to the God who has spoken the justification over me and know that because of that, I don't have to stand over others to know who I am, to know where I stand. And I can love my enemies. Because right where I am, at my worst, when I was, according to Romans, an enemy of God, he loved me. He gave me that agape love. And when you see that, that's the doorway to humility. Stepping into the posture that we're actually called to have in the world. And friends, don't believe the lie that our humility is a rejection of power. Humility is power. Humility is where the Spirit of God is. Jesus says, all who humble themselves will be exalted. And so that's what I'm praying for us today as we move into a time of communion and worshiping together. Is I just felt so convicted this week of my own postures, the way I stand over people in judgment, and Lord, just needing to humble me, just needing to be humble. So I want to pray for that for us as we move into this time of communion. Father, there are all sorts of things swirling around us on a weekly basis. We see stories, we see people, we see hear voices that are in opposition to everything that we believe. And God, how easily we can become angry, vindictive, judgmental, religious people. And so, Lord, I pray for humility. I pray, God, that we would be known as a people who are willing to listen to those who don't think and act and vote and live like us. That we're willing to do good to those who oppose us, who take advantage of us. And not from our own strength, because that won't happen. But because we have been loved, and because, Lord, you are our defender, our provider, our protector, our hope, we have power that the powers of this world cannot touch. So root us in that this morning, and as we see that, we humble ourselves before you, Jesus. Thank you for what you're going to do today. Speak again to us in Jesus' name. We're going to celebrate communion together. We have a column here that has some, if you forgot, we have some out in the lobby as well. We'd love for you to participate with us.